Okay, we got a question from Jeff Carroll in Seattle, and he's basically says he doesn't understand the 90-day seasoning with lease options and wants to know if you can explain it one more time. You know, you talked about how because of the FHA 90-day seasoning requirement, a lot of times you will offer a lease option, a short-term lease option to your buyers if that's a hang-up factor. Can you just kind of re-explain how that works?
Sure. When I do that, what I'm trying to do is balance the difference between managing my risk and trying to not lose a buyer. And as we all know, buyers have a very short attention span. So if I get a buyer that comes along and I find out that they are approved FHA, but I have a problem, and that is the 90-day seasoning. I have to wait 90 days. Now, this will always be less than 90 days by the time they come along and see my house. Unless, for example, let's just say it's 70 days. A buyer comes along, pays what I'm asking for or offers, and we have 70 days left until I've owned it for 90 days. If that's the case, one suggestion that I will make to the potential homeowners is for them to give me to get an FHA loan, they have to give me 3% down. They have to put up 3%. That's required. And what I suggest to them is for them to give me that 3% as an option fee, and they can actually move into my property. I do that. It's a non-refundable option fee. So if they decide to change their mind in 70 days from now, or if something else happens, I will be able to keep that money, which will hedge the risk of me having someone live in a house that isn't actually going to buy it. And then I charge them a monthly rent for the next month or two until that 90-day window comes along. And then once that happens, we then sign the purchase agreement, and typically we can close within a week or two of that. That 3% that they put down as an option fee is credited towards their down payment towards the purchase of the property. So they were going to have to put up that money anyways. The difference is they're putting it up before the 90-day mark, and it helps me because I get my buyer more locked in, and I get some money that if they walk, I'll be able to keep, and it helps them because they don't have to go look at more houses.
Now, sometimes you have I would imagine you have a bit of a sticking point with these people because, you know, they've got this hard-earned down payment, even if it's only 3%. That could be, you know, that could have taken a month to save up. And you're asking them to hand it over to you and trust that at the end of those 3 months, you're then going to apply that as the down payment once the 90-day seasoning is up and they can qualify for a loan. So, am I right that sometimes that's a sticking point, or is that not the case?
No, it is. And the thing that I really like to do is they typically are working with a buyer's agent. I like to do almost all the negotiating through the buyer's agent. I train the buyer's agent to go and present it in such a light that is in a light that I want to present it in. And I really utilize that third party. I actually take a lot of time to coach them, to train them, and say, okay, I'd like you to give them some options. Here's the pros. Here's the cons. Personally, I think that, you know, you could go, Mr. Buyer Agent, and you could go out and keep showing them houses, but if this is the one they like, I think it's worth giving them this option. And then a lot of times the buyer's agent will do the selling. They'll either come back and say, okay, I convinced them that this is the right thing to do, or they're just not comfortable doing that. And that's the biggest sticking point, is some people are just concerned about, losing what happens in 70 days from now if I can't get qualified or this or that. And it is a process. I mean, we got to coach them through and hold their hand. We got to make sure that when they move into the house, they don't go down to, a furniture rent-a-center and get, like, $10,000 of furniture and throw that on their credit, and then that might mess up their debt-to-income ratios. So there are some parties involved that have a vested interest, and we all kind of work together to make sure that everything goes well.
Which we laugh about, but that kind of stuff happens a lot of times. People just don't realize that they can't really change much of anything while they're waiting to get qualified.
Oh, yeah. I mean, new house, usually it's a bigger house than what they own, so they want to go out there and keep buying. So we have to communicate very clearly what will happen if they go and do that or what might potentially happen. So I've had several people who have decided not to do that. They'd rather just wait. Typically, if it's more than 60 days, I end up just finding another buyer. But that's not always the case, and it is an option that I'd like to offer potential buyers.
All right. Jeff had a part two to his question, and we mentioned earlier he's in Seattle, and he would like to know what strategies you would recommend for this model in higher-end cities like Seattle. How would you modify this, if at all?
Well, and I think we discussed that a little because I would consider where I live here in Utah to be a unique area like that, where the average sales price for a property out here is $400,000 to $500,000. And I've been trying to apply my 60% formula of that, and let's just say I'm usually a couple $100,000 off. So, you know, what I am doing in Utah is I'm adjusting my formula. I put a blog out there on my website about the verbal offers that I was doing, but in areas like that, I like to try to get a lot of offers out there and then get a counteroffer. And once I get a counteroffer, then I can shop that counteroffer and see if I can find any buyers. If I can't find any buyers, then I know I need to stick with that lower formula. If I do find buyers and repeatedly find buyers that are paying a lot more than the 60% formula, then I will adjust my formula in such a way where I will, go in and buy a property at, say, 75% of the after-repaired value versus 60%. This is something I just want to put out there, is sometimes in very high-end places where the risk would be extremely high to pay cash for a property, I really encourage people to go and look at doing short sales, because if you can get an offer accepted, and both you and I really recommend Sean McCloskey, and I actually just attended his seminar, but, short sales really work well if you are in an area where the average sales price is $700,000 and usually the biggest discount you can get is $100,000. Well, no one's going to go write a check for $600,000. That just doesn't make sense. But if you got a short sale, an option out there for $600,000, you might be able to sell for $650,000 and make $50,000.
Yeah, you know, one of the things, it is interesting about short sales, it seems easier to get the bank to take, you know, like a $40,000 loss
right
on a higher-end house than a $40,000 loss on, like, a $60,000 house. They, for some reason, they just have a harder time, even though the dollars are the same. So that's a great point to bring out. All right, next question is from Matt in Chicago, and he says, once you figure your after-repaired value and you get your MAO, your maximum allowable offer, how do you determine what price to market the property at for a quick sale? And I know you covered this a little bit before. Why don't you just hit the highlights on that right now?
Sure. My ARV is not maybe we should change that to ARV,
yeah,
to a different, I don't know, acronym besides ARV, but when
it's
I
clean
REO. My number that I use as the back end number that I'm going to sell it for, that's the price that I listed for. So I don't go into properties and say, okay, I think the ARV is 250. Follow the formula that puts me at a purchase price of 140, but I'm going to price it at 190 to sell it quickly. I look at it and say, how quick will this sell within 2 weeks? If 190 is the number, then I'm going to sell it for 190, and I use my formula based upon the 190, not a higher number, a retail number of 250. So I can use this as an example again. If there's some retail houses that have sold for 350, and there's a clean REO, clean foreclosure, several clean foreclosure comps at the 290 to 300 range, I'm going to look at that and say, okay, I'm going to sell this at 290. I take 290, and then I apply my formula, and that's the price that I'm going to sell my property for.
that's your ARV. Or actually, why don't we make up our own acronym now? We'll call
should.
It the CREO ARV. The CREO ARV. It's a little long and cumbersome, but hey, we own it. Moving into some of the other questions, I see we've got one question from Rob in Santa Cruz and one from GMO in Phoenix. I don't know what GMO stands for, but the one from GMO is, what do the figures look like for you in Utah as opposed to Detroit? Because, you know, you just recently moved from Detroit, which is really still where the core of your business is done. From Utah, you're doing these deals mostly in Detroit right now, but you've started to dip your toe into the Utah market. And by the way, I should say, if you guys haven't seen Bob's blog at bobnorton.com, go to bobnorton.com. He's actually got a video that he made that I thought was really interesting, where he it was about verbal offers being accepted on properties owned by the FDIC, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And you were actually at a house and you called and got the code and got in and walked around, and kind of gives a look at what you're dealing with right there in your own neighborhood. But I know you kind of already answered the question in terms of how the numbers should look in markets where the prices are heftier. Are you doing deals yet in Utah, or are you just kind of dipping your toe in the water and looking around?
Well, I'll use that house as an example. There's a lot of FDIC-owned properties out here because a certain bank got really loose on their lending standards, and a lot of builders got in trouble. So most of the foreclosures, and keep in mind where I'm at is kind of a resort second home community. There's only 130,000 people here, and half of the homeowners are at their second homes. So having said that, it's kind of a unique market here, but I want to use that house again as an example. That house is distressed. It's government owned. If you see on the video, there's no anything finished in there at all, so it needs a lot of work. They're asking $295, and I offered $150, I believe, or somewhere in the low to mid hundreds. Initially as a verbal offer, and ironically right on the sign it says verbal offers will be considered. So I'm still negotiating that house and several other houses that are FDIC owned around town. But I can just kind of tell you where I'm going with that deal. The back end numbers are going to be anywhere from $400,000 to $450,000 is what it's going to sell for. It's a 4,400 square foot home, and nowadays the houses are selling retail for about $100 a foot. And so if that number's 450, you know, I offered 150, and I got a counteroffer somewhere in the mid twos. Now I currently have a buyer at 225. He's a builder.
Okay, before you go to that, how? Clarify for me how you came up with that 150 number. Why that number?
Well, it pretty much was following my formula, and I'll do this right here. But if you take 450 times 60%, that's going to be, and I might have applied the 70% there, but that looks like that's going to be 270, as 60% of 450 is 270. Now, the house looks like it needs about $150 in repairs, so that would drop me down to an offer price of $120. So what I did is, obviously, if I could buy it for $120, following a formula of 60%, I mean, my profit margins are going to be quite high. I'm going to make some really good money on that house. Like we talked about a little bit earlier with, I think it was Jeff in Seattle, I've boosted my margins. I've cut my formula to 70% versus 60%. So it gets in a range there, because when you get really higher end, you can go in a little bit, you can bump up your formula. You can increase the percentage that you're buying it at from 60 to 70, because you're still going to make a lot of money. But again, I'm new to this market, so I'm being very conservative. So what I'm doing now is I found a builder who's willing to buy this for $225. He's tried to call the bank, but he's just confused. Most of the builders out here are so used to buying a lot and building a house that they don't really know how to do foreclosures. So I have a buyer at 225, and my goal right now is to try to get this house negotiated down to 200. I'll buy it for 200 and flip it to him for 225.
Okay.
Now, that's not selling it to a homeowner. That's just and the builder is my builder who built my house. So I don't really, I mean, it's just he keeps asking me, you know, how are you living out here? What are you doing? And by the way, that's, I think everybody, just as a little side comment, if people ever ask you, what do? You need to say, I flip houses. Because at some point, it seems like everyone's been interested. And even if it's timidly, they've always been interested in considering doing something like that. So I told him I flip houses, and really, and so over the course of him building our house, he's interested in getting a project. He just doesn't know how to do it. So that's just a good example. Now, that house needs so much work that I'm not really interested in trying to go in there and work on it enough to sell it to a homeowner. I mean, I'd rather that the house be like the house my in-laws bought, which is four doors down, same builder, same situation. But that house had cabinets, it had all these type of things. And so that house would have been a lot easier. That's a house that I was trying to buy for $300 and flip for $350, and it was listed for $395. Now, you kind of go, well, you know, if I would have followed my formula, I needed to buy the house for $200 instead of $300. But they ended up buying it in the mid-threes, and it was a great deal for them. So the formula worked really well for wholesaling to another homeowner. You can cut your margins, but you just got to understand your market. So I hope that didn't get more confusing. But the key thing is I'm doing it in Utah. I haven't actually closed the deal here in Utah. I haven't really tried to, but I have a lot of offers out there. And I'm doing what I was recommending to Jeff in Seattle, and that is I'm coming in very low on my offers. Typically, I'm usually a couple hundred thousand dollars off from what I'm offering and what the bank is asking. But they will counteroffer me. There's a house that they were asking $350. I offered $150, and they countered me at $250. So they came down $100,000. I still am not interested at $250, as I just don't think it's going to sell for more than $400,000 or $450,000, but I'm applying the formula of 60%. That's the formula I'm applying. But the point is once I get a verbal offer, if you could find a buyer who's willing to pay $20,000 or $30,000 more than that, then you can go in, you can control the transaction, and you can lock that property up, and you can really come up higher than what you initially offered simply because you have a buyer. But there's no risk in it. I'm offering such a low number, there's no risk in, you know, if a bank is asking $400 and I offer $150 and they actually take it, well, by golly, I'm a very happy person because I never expected them to do it. I'm offering so much lower, and there's zero risk in offering low balls. And I think people who are in higher end markets, that's what they need to do just to get that counter offer, and then they can try to shop it from there.
You know, you've mentioned that. That's the third time specifically in this conversation you've mentioned shopping it. And I, if you don't mind, I'd like to ask you to clarify a point on that. Like with this house in Utah, and maybe that's not the best example because I think you already knew that builder, but when you make an offer on a house and you're waiting for that counteroffer and you get that counteroffer, I mean, at that point, you have kind of a time clock ticking. You know, they're waiting to hear back from you. You don't have to respond back immediately, but, you know, within a day or two, I would think, they're waiting to hear back from you. So you don't have a large window to, as you say, shop.
I don't do anything. I don't call them back. I don't tell them anything. I just ignore them.
So how long do you take to shop it before you finally respond to their counter?
I don't. If I don't find a buyer, I don't respond to their counter.
Okay, so I guess there's a possibility.
Let me give an example. I just I have several students who are making offers all the time in Michigan, and this just happened. I think it was yesterday, the day before, so it's just fresh off the top of my head. The clean foreclosure number is right around 170, 180. The student offered 108. Following the formula, they should have offered about $80,000, but they offered $108,000. because they thought the clean foreclosure number was much higher than what I think it is. So they offered 108. The house was listed for, I think, 160. The bank countered them at 125. And they got really excited. They're like, wow, they just came down 30 grand. And most bank, you know, when a bank drops that much in a counteroffer, usually it means that something might happen. So they're like, what should we do? What do we do? And I said, don't do anything. And they're like, what do you mean? I'm like, take the 125, and you've already told me that you know some people who might be interested in paying 140 or 150 for that. Go and see if they're interested. Get the buyer first, and then we can get into this a little bit more. So that's what they're doing. It's got a little bit of mold and a couple other little things, but they're trying to shop it right now. And then, because all you're trying to do when you make an offer that's ridiculously low or that you're following your formula is you're just trying to figure out where the bank's really at. You're like poking them with a needle, and you just want to see if they're going to react. And they really showed their cards. They kind of said, here's where we're at. We're at 125. And what they're really saying is they're lower than that, because they drop significantly. You know, the way banks negotiate is they think they need to meet in the middle. So if they're at 150, you offer 100, and they come back at 125, what they're going to do is, in their mind, they're trying to meet you in the middle between 100 and 125. Now, that's not a hard, proven formula that they do, but that's typically how they negotiate. So what they're really saying is, hey, if you come up to 112, 115, this deal is yours. So the bank's really at about 115. That's where they're at. So I don't do anything. I don't respond back. I know where the bank's at now. I don't have to do anything. Typically, the agent might call back in a week or so and say, what happened to your buyer? Did they bug out? No. They just, you counteroffered them. Okay, well, what's your buyer going to do? Nothing. And then the conversation might go, well, do you want us to resubmit or counteroffer? No, that's my buyer's offer, and if you want to resubmit my buyer's offer again at the same price, feel free to go ahead and do that. And that's all I do. I mean, I know where the bank's at. All I wanted to do is figure out where the bank's at. Now, I will admit that after 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, the bank might be willing to come down even more, and that's where I'll go at and dig at them again. But most of the time, if they were ready to accept your offer, they would accept it. If they counteroffer you, that they're kind of just telling you, this is where I'm at right now. I'm not ready to go any lower than this. So then I just, in my mind, there's no need to respond. If I do respond, I'm not going to come up in price. Now, I will come up in price if I have a buyer. That's when I respond. So I try to go find the buyer based off that counteroffer, and then I step in and respond after that.
Okay. All right. So that makes sense. I guess there's this pressure that you tend to feel like when they respond, it's like, oh, what am I going to do? You know, kind of running around in circles, like trying to figure out what you got to say next. And
sure.
You're pretty much laying back.
Let's say that counteroffer is only good for 2 days. Well, that's pretty stupid of them to do that, because they're going to look really dumb after 2 days. Because what if you come back in a week and then you say, oh, I guess you're up at the high price again, and just for some reason you were just going to take a low offer for 2 days, and now you're not going to take a low offer anymore. You know, they it's just their way of trying to make you feel like there's pressure. Another way that the right. banks do that is they like to tell you there's multiple offers. Even though their other offer might be 50 grand less than yours, they like to come back and tell everybody there's multiple offers, we're looking for your highest and best. It's just little things that they do to try to negotiate a higher price. Those type of things don't faze me at all. When I see that, I just say, well, you know, I made an offer to you. That's my number. I'm not going to change from that number. It doesn't matter what happens. And, again, the best properties to go after are the ones that got some problems, even in the minds of the bank. And, you know, I want people to understand that it's quite difficult for me to buy a house for 60 cents on the clean foreclosure dollar that only needs carpet and paint. That is very hard to do. The odds of me getting a deal like that are quite low. But what I can do is I can get a house that's got some mold growing for 50 or 60 cents on the clean foreclosure dollar clean up that mold and then price it properly. So I am still looking for properties that have problems. And the banks are pretty smart. They know the other offers that they're getting from the other homeowners. So they're not just going to mystically just, okay, here, we're going to sell this house for $50,000 less just because of something. Now, there are some variables that will change that, but most of the time they're not going to do that. That's why I like to cherry pick. Once you learn your area, you just kind of look for the deals that are priced right from the very get-go that you can pay full price for.